Hey there, we're back. This is Microsoft Technical Summit 2016. We're here in Darmstadt, Germany, and I have a special guest with us today.
Oh, thank you.
How are you doing, my friend?
I'm good. And yourself,
great.
My friend?
Way to start it awkward, I'm just saying. So tell us who you are and what you do, my friend.
Sure. I'm Olivia. I'm a software development engineer at Microsoft in a group called TED, Technical Evangelism and Development.
So what do you specialize in?
So I help global enablers or global ISVs onboard their solutions on Azure. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, I have my focus area, everything to do with machine learning, artificial intelligence, and now with the newest hype called deep learning.
Awesome. So those are also my favorite things.
I know.
And so you had a talk here. Why don't you give us sort of a quick overview of the talk? And maybe because it was in German and it's going to be recorded online, I thought you would maybe in English give us a shorter overview of what you talked about.
Yeah, sure. So maybe you can see it in the background as well. We have this nice picture of some white guys.
Actually, this is me when I was in college with the beard.
The far
right one. That was me. I've gained some weight. Got a tan.
You're looking better now.
Thank you. Yeah, I look a little better.
You look very healthy.
Thank you. Yes, that's right.
Well, okay, so basically we talked about, or Marcel and I talked about, the evolution of artificial intelligence. Why is the computer still so dumb? So we started off with, like, okay, what is the history of artificial intelligence in general? And it pretty much had the beginnings in 1956 with a conference or summer workshop in Dartmouth, which was actually organized by John McCarthy, who you can see in that picture as well. The one with the glasses, and he just organized a summer camp, invited a bunch of people. I think in the end there were 49 attendees, and
wow.
Then they just did a lot of brainstorming for 6 to 8 weeks to discuss what is actually artificial intelligence. They actually decided on that term, artificial intelligence, as well. I think there were some other alternatives as well, but it sounded much more theoretical.
Sure.
Actually, just going through the next one, they actually decided on 6 sort of principles or concepts on artificial intelligence in general. So the first one being reasoning. So the idea is that the computer should be able to do a lot of very sophisticated tasks, such as playing chess, as you can see here in this picture, or another one would be solving algebra problems, for instance. And here in this picture, we can see, most of you must have heard about Deep Blue. So the 1997, I think, was the first time that Deep Blue, the chess computer, won against the world chess champion.
Kasparov, right?
Yeah.
And he was angry about this, though. He was angry. He thought the computer cheated somehow.
Oh, yeah, because he was of the impression that there was some very unusual move that has been happening there, and he said, like, okay, this can't be done by a computer because it would be very unusual or very creative, mm-hmm. and therefore also said, yeah, there must have been some people cheating there. But IBM has reassured that there was no cheating.
Right.
So this is one example. Then the other one, or another one, is knowledge representation. So the idea is everything that you can see in the world, like, you can represent it. You can describe it to your computer. So what does a person look like? What is a lamp, and so on and so forth. And here you can see John McCarthy, the guy who actually organized that camp, being the inventor of Lisp, so a language mm-hmm. designed to actually describe every single object in the world. The next one, planning. Okay, we always think about it, like, how do we get faster from A to B? So navigation. This is, here you can see Shaky the robot, 1967. This was the first robot that was self-driving.
Uh-huh.
And you can see all those cameras attached to it as well. So it was managed, it actually managed to travel or to drive from one point to another in some certain time frame as well.
It's a huge looking robot we got going on there. It's kind of ugly. Now we got
do
like
you see that line?
We got like Raspberry Pis that will do whatever that did, right?
Yeah. You should definitely do a comparison between your Raspberry Pi robot that is coming up very soon.
Yeah,
and this one.
That's right. You'll have to send me some more details. That would be an interesting comparison to add to my talk, which is going to happen next month sometime. Cool.
I'm intrigued.
I love it, yes. You even have a link there, so I'll have to go back for that, yeah.
Then the next one, natural language processing. Okay, this is, I think, nowadays the biggest hype about deep learning, everything about speech recognition. How can you understand someone? What is language? How do you form a sentence? And it's actually a really hard problem. This is just a picture of the Georgetown IBM experiment, 1954. So that was even before that infamous AI conference. Mm-hmm. And this one was to translate from Russian to English and did really well for 60 chosen sentences, but did really badly in all the other sentences because it was actually just a word-by-word translation as well.
And I will say that this is the area that I actually did some research in, and it is a very hard problem. It's a very hard problem.
But since then, it has obviously improved,
right?
Because it was more than 50 years ago now.
Sure.
More than 60 years ago.
Yeah.
But this is actually one of the typical AI winters where it was a boom and then a bust cycle of artificial intelligence. Another aspect of AI is perception, which is, okay, can we teach a computer to listen or to hear, to see something, to feel something, to smell something? And here, this is the first experiment with Marvin Minsky to teach the robot to see, actually, to also gather that you can't actually put a block on top of a pyramid because it wouldn't hold. So here Marvin just pretty much tells the robot, okay, put a block on top of the pyramid, and the robot is supposed to say it's possible or not possible, and if it is possible, then it would do that. And then, obviously, the holy grail of AI in general is generalized intelligence. We all know the movies or Star Wars. So the idea is, can we, like, based on all those building blocks that we've gone through, can we then build this generalized intelligence so that there's some emotion in it? And the funny thing with here 3CPO, it's a robot. It actually has that fear as well, because saying like, oh no, I'm really scared of this one, and mm-hmm. runs away. So it does have some emotions, but then on the other hand, it's not really, you wouldn't really want to identify with it because it's not really, it doesn't really have the empathy,
right.
I guess. So like not too much feeling, but.
So yeah. for all of these six areas, do you feel like they're interrelated somehow nowadays? Do you feel that that categorization still holds even like 60 years later?
I think, so later on, there are some slides as well on like, okay, we have examples that it is working right now, or it has progress. I guess some of them are definitely interlinked somehow.
Right.
Because I guess the point we find with perception, it is somehow linked to natural language processing as well, because it is about hearing, and then so first you need to get all those audio files, mm-hmm. And then need to process what you've actually heard or what you've gathered in terms of audio raw data.
And then you might need to do more language things like translate or get understanding out of there as well.
Yeah.
So as I'm looking at this, I'm like my field is fairly narrow, right? I know about predictive machine learning. I know a little bit about that. It feels like when we're looking at AI, it's a much broader sort of thing than just that.
Yeah.
And so if someone is like looking at this field thinking, I want to get into AI, I want to do X or Y, like how does this history help them sort of get up to speed with what they should be doing? Like today there's some dev, her name is Sue, she manages 10 devs, and she's like, I need to use machine learning to solve a problem. Does this sort of understanding help? How does this help her get to speed with this stuff? You see what I'm saying?
So like how does machine learning relate to AI?
No, how does the history of AI sort of, how does it help us sort of understand like where we can go with it? Because I'm looking at the history and I'm like, wow, this is super interesting. How would I use this knowledge to sort of further what I'm doing with my software, for example? Right?
Well, so history has shown that certain problems are actually really hard. So we've mentioned the machine translation, and therefore it has gone through like some boom and bust cycle. And meaning that after the bust cycle, no one was interested in it. If you were still like doing research in that field, it was pretty much like your end of the career. So I guess it's useful to know about it, to see, okay, how can we learn from it? Like, not that you actually spent so much time on like doing the very same mistakes. Then on the other hand, what I find interesting is like, yeah, we mentioned deep learning just at the very beginning. It's everyone is doing deep learning at the moment.
Right.
We were talking beforehand as well about when I did my master's, and then I talked to my supervisor, oh, okay, so what about neural networks? Because at that point it was all about SVMs or random forest.
Same with me when I was in school.
And my supervisor was like, well, neural networks, this is so the 90s. We are not going to do anything with neural networks. And,
right.
And the thing is, deep learning is based on neural networks. It's just, yeah,
deeper.
A much deeper.
Yeah, and sometimes they talk back to each other, the neurons.
Exactly, or it has some like shortcuts.
Right.
But yeah, at the moment, there's definitely a boom cycle and or a boom with deep learning. And then the question is, does it mean that there's going to be another AI winter with deep learning?
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it so hyped at the moment that like at some point it's just gonna reach the same point that machine translation or expert systems or micro worlds have reached before, and that, okay, we can't get any further. But on the other hand, people like Andrew Ng have argued that this is not going to be another AI winter, just because looking at speech recognition has been a field of, or an area of research for
forever.
Decades.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it has improved just minimally over the first decades. And then suddenly when Microsoft Research tried out deep learning on speech recognition, in 2009, without actually doing a lot of tweaking or doing the weights in the deep learning network, they reached much better results than they ever had beforehand. So so at the moment, yeah, with deep learning, the results are just too good that
you're not thinking it's going to go away. So you mentioned AI winters. Will you describe those a little bit so people get a sense for what that means?
Yeah, sure. I can just like forward a little bit. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Winter is coming.
Oh, wow. It's almost as if I knew what was happening.
So this is the first AI winter that we have talked about a little bit beforehand. So anything to do with machine translation. We've mentioned already the Georgetown IBM experiment, and I think you can talk much more about it since you've actually studied that field. But the thing is, and while it was being demoed, it went really great, but it was because there were those 60 sentences that you can imagine like being on a punch card. Input is a punch card with an English sentence, I think, and then out came a Russian sentence also on a punch card. But then it really didn't go that well once you did more sentences or like from a different context. So they've realized in this time span of 11 years, I guess that they didn't really get much further, and they realized that machine translation, as you said, is a really hard problem. So this committee actually says, okay, it's not going anywhere, so this is not really such a great area of research, so let's just skip it for now.
So AI winter is a period of time where they stop looking at a particular kind of problem or a particular kind of algorithm?
So AI winter, as far as I think, is this time frame of a boom or a hype, and then the disillusionment.
Got it.
Followed by that. So this is one AI winter. Although probably like going back to the Game of Thrones style, winter is coming, maybe it's just the bust thing,
right.
Like when the bubble pretty much just like burst.
Sure.
So this is the first AI winter. There have been about like 6 to 7 AI winters until now. These are the most notable ones. So this is AI winter number 2, the golden age, or I usually call it the micro worlds, because then with machine translation, they learned the lesson, like, okay, actually translating a whole sentence or a whole language is really difficult, so let's try to narrow it down. So this is why they mentioned like micro worlds, so I have a very constrained world. And one example, you probably know it as well, Eliza.
Of course.
So like one test, the Turing test, uh-huh. is when you talk to someone and this person responds, is it does it sound like a human being is talking or not? And the ELISA, or ELISA is pretty much just an imitation of a talk therapist.
Yeah.
And what ELISA pretty much just did was use the sentences and then just change the syntax a little so that it pretty much sounded like a talk therapist is talking to
you. And it's really good. Like, you can go online and look at ELISA implementations on the web, and when you talk to it, it talks back to you, and it's, if you talk to it for like maybe two or three times, it's like, wow, this is, but as you start to talk to it more, then you start to get a sense for it.
Then you know, machine. Okay. Yeah, because I think
it was
it's,
really good.
I think it's like actually programmed towards certain keywords, like mother, my boss is giving me a hard time.
It used case framing to pull out certain things, and then it used those parts of speech to sort of put it back into another frame. It's not as clever as people think, but it actually is, because of its simplicity, it feels really clever, and it is really clever. You know, I think the greatest things we've ever invented are the cleverest things that have the simplest solutions, right?
Good point, yeah. I guess like one example for ELISA really failing badly is, I think if you ask ELISA like, oh, I want to know more about you, and then ELISA would respond like, oh, why do you think you would want to know more about me? Because I want to write a report. Oh, how does it make you feel to write a report about me? So it kind of makes sense, like you see that it doesn't make any sense at all. Like, why does ELISA keep on asking those
questions?
Like,
it makes sense, but there's a hollowness about the conversation that eventually will fall out.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's my sense of that. So.
But yeah, so this actually went through another bust, mm-hmm. pretty much. That hype bursted as well, that ultimately one report from the UK government, I think, it said, yeah, okay, AI has failed us in their big objectives and their big goals. We might as well just skip it.
And this was 1974 that they're saying AI has failed. This is before like we even had good machines, right?
I mean, yeah.
We didn't have good machines until like the 90s, where people could use these things at home, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
I always find it so funny with the IBM Georgetown experiment that they use punch cards for this.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah, I still use punch cards.
Hence the picture
beforehand. Yeah, hence the I shaved my beard though, so yeah, awesome.
And have dyed your hair a little as well.
Yes, of course, and I grew it back too. It's a miracle.
That's impressive.
Thank you. Yeah, it took me a lot of work and some push-ups. So there you go.
Really? But yeah, so, and then they learned their lesson as well from the micro worlds, saying, okay, we failed at translating a whole language. We failed at constraining the world a little bit. How about we constrain it even more on just very highly sophisticated tasks? So this is what they call expert systems. So the strategy here was you find an expert on a certain area, you interview that expert as many times as possible, and then try to program his or her knowledge into a set of rules. And this, I think the first one, was in 1965. So one of the typical use cases for an expert system is diagnosing blood diseases, for instance. And it worked quite nicely. But then on the other hand, the intention behind these expert systems is, how about we do a lot of small expert systems and then build on top of each other so that in the end we have one super expert system. But it didn't actually scale as nicely as they expected or they wished, because when you want to move to another domain area and want to build an expert system, you actually have to go through this whole process again of finding another expert, interrogating these experts, and then programming this knowledge into a set of rules again. So it didn't, like, they couldn't really leverage from all the other expert systems before. And so probably this has been like the biggest bust of this bubble, because a lot of startups have been created based on this one, and a couple of years later, then those startups pretty much just collapsed.
Kaput. That's
kaput.
German, right? Nice.
Nice one.
Yes, thank you. I really try. And so this created another AI winter, right? It was AI winter number three. I said second, but third. Were people, would they lose confidence in AI again? Or what do you mean by AI winter? People were like, this is not going to work.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, there's no use in actually spending any more money in this one. And the thing is, like, once you stop investing or putting funding in special areas, then no one is actually going to bother like doing that. And
right.
That's the same thing that happened to deep learning, that it started already in like the 60s. And those people who did spend their research or spend their time researching deep learning, they were pretty much just like stamped off as, well, okay, they are not going to get really far in their research career.
Right. Now, would you say the reason why neural networks didn't work in the 90s was because of computational constraints, or was it that the models were not good?
That's a good question. The typical reasons that are given why deep learning is successful now as opposed to before and is usually given in terms of, there is scale in data, there is scale in compute. So we have all the data. We now have a lot of compute power, which we didn't have back then. So I guess, this could be one of the reasons why deep learning or neural networks didn't really hit it off back then.
Because I remember when I studied when I was studying these things, machine learning, like, I remember talking about neural networks, and I remember understanding them. You know, they're just generalized perceptrons with higher levels, right? I understood mathematically what was going on. The thing that bothered me about them is that the function was not optimizable, right?
Yeah.
And the problem is, like, there's... So listen, here's my take on certain kind of functions. If you look at, like, the function x squared, it's a u, always know where the minimum is.
Yeah.
Take the first derivative, set it equal to zero, right? And then you find the exact point. But the thing about the function with neural networks is it's this, like, weird function, right? And so if you set the derivative of that function to zero, you get a lot of answers, right? And you need to know, well, which one is the most minimum? And where do you look? Like, what's the window? And so the thing that troubled me about neural networks is the optimization process. And that's why I liked SVM, because it was nice and tidy. It was a really nice function, and it had a single optimum, you know. And to
so
me,
you did a lot of SVM.
I loved SVMs because of that. But now we're finding that the deeper you go with neural networks, the more interesting the kind of learning that happens in the intermediate layers, right?
Yeah.
And so that's where I'm like, I'm kind of like rethinking it, right?
So are you considering to do some more research in the deep learning space?
I'm interviewing you. You stop that. No. And so all I'm saying is that these winters seem to have happened because of constraints in knowledge of algorithms and constraint in actual compute power, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's actually... I think 2012 was pretty much the year where deep learning suddenly... where deep learning experienced a renaissance,
right,
pretty much. So I think there were like two key events. One event is where Rick Rashid, like the former boss of Microsoft Research, gave his keynote in China in English, but then it was simultaneously translated into Mandarin in his own voice. And that was using deep learning.
Which is pretty remarkable. That's like Star Trek level stuff, you know, like
automatic
translator stuff that you look at and you're like, that could never happen. But it did. It happened on stage, right?
Yeah. So I think this is one event. And another event was when Andrew Ng was using a deep learning model to just figure out what is being posted on YouTube. And he used 10 million YouTube videos and had like 1,000 computers with 16 cores each. So yeah, you can see it definitely has the data, definitely has the compute. And they figured out that a lot of people post a lot of videos on cats, pretty much.
Well, thank you so much. We're out of time. They're giving the wrap symbol. We're going to go to a session, and then we'll come back with an interview right after this. Take care.